Hello. If you're hearing my voice right now, then you have stumbled onto the podcast where real stories of professional criminal profilers are told by professional assholes. Welcome to Profiling Pain. Hey, how's it going, co-fathers? Last time we talked, we did the Halloween special where we talked about the Candyman and how that asshole killed his own kids for insurance money. This time, we're coming at the heels of another holiday. In the United States, we just celebrated Thanksgiving, which is essentially just a celebration of our gluttony and how we overthrew a country. So that's about it. We had a lot of family here this weekend. We had 3 dogs, 7 adults, 9 kids. It was just a bird, a cat. It was like a zoo in my house. But it was fun. It was cool seeing everybody. We had family come from Colorado, from all over the state of Arizona, which I know we weren't supposed to do, but we're all fine. We're all still alive. The only thing that was dead was the turkey. So we're all doing great. I hope for those of you in the United States, you guys had a great Thanksgiving. And for those of you abroad, I hope you guys just had a good weekend in general and everything's going all right. Let's see. Well, Biden is presidential elect. I know that a few episodes ago we talked about the way the Electoral College works, and that's what we're still waiting on. I believe the Electoral College doesn't have to put in their votes until December 9th, and then we'll see who comes out with that. Maybe there'll be a Supreme Court dispute. Depends on whether or not Trump plans on going off quietly into the night, which we already know he's not planning on doing. So for the countries watching around the world and waiting to see what happens, I have zero insight for you. And then for everybody here who has drawn a line in the sand, shut up. It doesn't fucking matter. It just doesn't matter. But we'll see. We'll see what happens. In the meantime, speaking of having family over this weekend, for this last episode of Ted Bundy, where we're going to cover the modus operandi, pretty much his motives and his criminal profile. And also, we're going to cover how he changed criminal profiling and different precincts in the way the FBI and regular police actually correspond and like central databases and shit. So, I mean, it's just cool little interesting facts. It'll probably be boring if you're only into the blood and guts, which we're going to cover a lot of blood and guts in this still. We're going to give you a quick rundown of what he did and how he did it again, just in case anybody forgot over the course of the last 4 episodes. And then we're also going to talk about what he did to help catch the Green River Killer or just things that he contributed as a psychopath himself. But in light of having a lot of family over, my brother-in-law Anthony actually is going to be on this episode with me. So Anthony, go ahead and say what's up.
Hey, what's happening, guys?
So me and Anthony like to play a lot of board games. We play a lot of board games. But recently we've gotten really into certain like cold case file games. Okay. One of them is literally called cold case files, and you can get them at what Walmart, on Amazon, yeah, Target, and then you know you got the Hunt to Kill or anything else like that. And yet I'm still not sponsored by this shit, which what the fuck. So if you're somebody that you know runs that shit and listens to episodes, I'll take a sponsorship right and left. But we've played
We've solved so many murders.
So many murders. We've solved so many murders. I think we've really only really solved 4 so far.
4 or 5, yeah.
But we try to get all the other ones coming out and stuff like that. And I think one of these days on the Profiling Pain podcast Facebook page, I think we might do a Facebook Live, and we'll put out which case we're gonna do a couple weeks ahead of time. And then maybe we'll all solve it together. And if you guys want to get in on that, you guys could do the whole live thing with us, and you know we'll trade back and forth with the comments and all that other shit. And so if you guys find stuff that we haven't yet, we can work it out. I think that'd be fun to do.
That'd be pretty nice.
So anyway, getting into it. So how much do you actually know about Ted Bundy?
Only what I saw about the Netflix and here and there of the past that I've lived through.
So. What? What the hell? Anyway, so you're talking about the Ted Bundy tapes.
Yes.
Right, okay. And then I guess the also the Netflix special movie with Zac Efron.
I actually haven't even seen that yet.
Me neither. I've been planning on watching it, but after doing all this, I figured I'd watch the movie after doing all the research and after. Yeah. That way I'm not sitting there going, you're wrong, and I can just enjoy the movie. because it won't be fucking up my research. I'd hate to be like, and then Zac Efron snuck in through the window, and then I just completely fucked up everything I'm doing.
Fuck you, Zac Efron.
Yeah, fuck you, Zac Efron. I'm with that right there. High School Musical, my ass. So anyway, let's get into it. So the modus operandi in his victim profile. Now, Bundy in custody, Leon County, Florida. Bundy had a fairly consistent modus operandi, which is just fucking his MO is the short term for that. So what he did, what was his go to for his murders. So he would approach a potential victim in a public place, even in daylight or in a crowd, as when he abducted Ott and Noslin at Lake Sammamish in Washington, which I'm sure we covered that on three different episodes, so you guys already know how that went down. Or the way that he kidnapped Leach from her school. So Bundy had various ways of gaining a victim's trust. Sometimes he would feign injury. We talked about that with the arm in a sling, right? Wearing his arm in a sling or wearing a fake cast, as in the murders of Hawkins, Raincourt, Ott, Naslin, and Cunningham. And at other times, Bundy would impersonate an authority figure. He pretended to be a policeman oftentimes. And if you go back and remember the Hillside Stranglers, they pretended to be cops a handful of times too. So always beware. And that's how he ended up approaching Carol DeRanche. And if you remember, Carol DeRanche was the one that got away and then actually was did a testimony against him later on in court. The day before he killed Kimberly Leach, Bundy approached another young Florida girl pretending to be Richard Burton Fire Department. But he left hurriedly after her older brother arrived. So he didn't get everybody he went for. Bundy had a remarkable advantage in that his facial features were attractive, yet not especially memorable. So it's like, you know, I'd fuck him, but I probably would forget him. And in later years, he'd often be described as a chameleon-like, able to look totally different by making only minor adjustments to his appearance. I imagine him, like, sitting there and just having, like, a whole briefcase full of different mustaches. You know what I mean? He'd be like, meh, I think today I'll go... Right. He's essentially Seth Rogen's character from Pineapple Express, where he's got a bunch of different costumes. Just like, all right, this chick's about to get served. Murder. So, you know, he'd work on growing a beard or changing his hairstyle. So he would play the long game. And I don't think that they had Just for Men and Rogaine back then. So he was putting in real work. All of Bundy's victims were white females, and most were of middle class background. So he definitely had, he's like, yeah, so I want them to have a little money. And I also want them to have milky skin. I don't want anybody who's willing to fight back from the hood by any means. So obviously he went for somebody who he viewed to be a weak person, especially going after girls between the ages of 15 and 25. Now, if you remember, we even talked about the potential of him as young as 14 committing murders on younger women. So he was a freak from birth. Now, many were college students. In a book that was written by Stephanie Brooks, Rule, in her book and in her notes, she points out that most of Bundy's victims had long, straight hair parted in the middle, just like Stephanie Brooks, the woman who Bundy was engaged to in 1973. So there's a certain type of murderer out there where they say that, like, you get into a fight with your wife, you look for someone just like your wife to kill because you can't kill your wife. Right? I mean, you could totally kill your wife, but that's a lot more suspicious than some random person in the street.
Who do you know that says that?
Well, okay, so you do enough of these episodes, you start to, like, they talk, everybody that's ever had, like, mommy issues, 9 times out of 10, they go for people who look like their mothers too when they were young, or, I mean, it's kind of gross. It's like a strange Oedipus complex, but he seemed to go for the same type of girl every time. So, Rule also speculates that Bundy's resentment towards his first girlfriend was a motivating factor in his string of murders. Now, I was actually explaining this to our other brother-in-law, Ben, the other night, that there's things that murderers do where they, it's like building up, giving yourself allowances. So, like, for instance, say, petty theft. You start off just robbing liquor stores, right? Yeah. Right, and then you get away with it. And then you move on to, like, assault and battery. You know what I mean?
It's like getting high.
Right, and then you're always chasing that bigger high.
Well, it's not doing it for me anymore. I gotta do this.
Right, and while you're going through that, you're also giving yourself little allowances. Like, well, I didn't get caught. I didn't do anything bad then. Or, like, all of a sudden you start to accept it as you're not doing anything wrong.
Yeah.
And then eventually it turns into what everybody calls a berserker phase, and that's when you go for big air, and you're just, like, trying to take out... I mean, you're just killing a lot more people in a shorter amount of time than you usually would, and 9 times out of 10 in the midst of their berserker phase is when they all get caught.
Yeah.
Because you get reckless. 1980 interview, Bundy dismissed this hypothesis. They just fit the general criteria of being young and attractive. Too many people have bought this crap that all the girls were similar. Similar hair, same color, parted in the middle. But if you look at it, almost everything was dissimilar. Physically, they were almost all different, says Bundy. He didn't like being typed. He didn't like being profiled. He had this arrogance about him. I mean, sociopath, obviously. But he thought that he was better than everybody else. So nobody really knew him. And if you remember the Ted Bundy tapes, he would talk in the third person a lot. Or like when he would talk about himself, he'd be like, oh, the dark entity or the dark creature or whatever. He would never really,
yeah,
you know, fess up to the shit.
Into it.
Right. And after luring a victim to his car, Bundy would hit her in the head with a crowbar he had placed underneath his Volkswagen or hidden inside of it. Which, for him being a narcissist, I don't know why he drove a Volkswagen Beetle.
I mean, at that point in time, it was the hardest. It was the most
common thing on the planet. Yep.
So it's, I mean, in his mind, it's easier to get away.
Side note, I knew a guy who had a Volkswagen Beetle, and you know how, like, I don't know about you, but like when I was younger, car clubs were like the big thing for every dude.
Yeah.
And they all had like 1960s to like 1970s Volkswagen Beetles, and the stickers on the back said "Nut Sack Racing." Because it looks like little scrotums of wheels, you know what I mean?
Much.
Nutsack Racing, I thought that was funny as shit. Anyway, every recovered skull except for that of Kimberly Leach showed signs of blunt force trauma. Every recovered body except for that of Leach showed signs of strangulation. Many of Bundy's victims were transported a considerable distance from where they had disappeared, as in the case of Kathy Parks, whom he drove more than 260 miles from Oregon to Washington. Bundy often would drink alcohol prior to finding a victim. Carol DeRonch testified to smelling alcohol in his breath. Hagmeier stated that Bundy considered himself to be an amateur and impulsive killer in his early years, and then moved into what he considered to be his prime or predator phase. As the arrogance grows, so is, you know, the sociopath way. Bundy stated that this phase began around the time of the Linda Healy murder, when he began seeking victims he considered to be equal to his skill as a murderer. On death row, Bundy admitted to decapitating at least a dozen of his victims with a hacksaw. He kept the several heads later found on Taylor. And, you know, I think when you go back and you cover all this, how much work they really put in, because I don't think that there was, like, DeWalt Sawzalls in the 70s. You know what I mean? Like, they had to actually physically, like, saw, and, I mean, you just wanted it more. You know what I mean?
I guess that's the way to put it, yeah. I just wanted it more.
It's like when one team wins the champion and the other one doesn't. You know, I mean, you just wanted it more. I don't know. Like, I mean, nowadays, it'd be like if you're on a construction site and you had, like, but it was prison. You know what I mean? It was an actual construction site, but it's like a prison. And you had, like, the old inmate talking to the young inmate, like, back in my day, we had to use a bone saw.
Yeah, like a wood saw.
I hear you youngin' sitting here discussing who's better, DeWalt or Milwaukee. Anyway. So, he kept the several heads later found on Taylor Mountain, Raincourt Parks, Ball, and Healy in his room or apartment for some time before finally disposing of them. He confessed to cremating Donna Manson's head in his girlfriend's fireplace, which I don't know if he was actually able to do that. You have to get the fire a lot hotter than a fireplace in order to cremate him, I would assume. But some of the skulls of Bundy's victims were found with the front teeth broken out. Bundy also confessed... Jesus, yeah? Bundy also confessed to visiting his victims' bodies over and over again at the Taylor Mountain body dump site. He stated that he would lie with them, talk to them, and just hang out with them for hours, applying makeup to their corpses and even having sex with their decomposing bodies until putrefaction forced him to abandon the remains. Now, that part is fucking, man, like... Murder is terrible. Murder is really, really terrible. But, I mean, when you move into necrophilia, I feel like there's something way worse than just having a rage problem. There's a major underlining issue there. I mean, a mental issue that I don't think anybody can really wrap their head around. Not long before his death, Bundy actually admitted to returning to the corpse of Georgianne Hawkins for purposes of necrophilia. Bundy confessed to keeping other souvenirs of his crimes. The Utah police who searched Bundy's apartment in 1975 missed a collection of photographs that Bundy had hidden in the utility room, photos that Bundy destroyed when he returned home after being released on bail. His girlfriend Elizabeth once found a bag in his room filled with women's clothing, and when Bundy was confronted by law enforcement officers who stated that they believed the number of individuals he had murdered was 36, Bundy told them that they should add one digit to that and you'll have it. So he's confessing to over 100 murders at that point, which would have put him in the history books as like the number one murderer of all time. There's the checkerboard killer or the chessboard killer who tried to fill in a square, every square on the chessboard with a murder victim. And then there's the Red Ripper, who was a Russian-style Jack the Ripper. I'm trying to remember his name at the top of my head, but I can't. But I've listened to his story multiple times, and he was going for big airs as well. Andre Chikatilo was the Red Ripper, I believe. And there's a handful of other guys that got above the 40 range, and I think Bundy might have overstated. However, Rule speculated that this meant Bundy might have killed over 100 women. And speaking to his lawyer, Polly Nelson, in 1988, Bundy dismissed the 100-plus victim speculation and said that the more common estimate of approximately 35 victims was accurate pathology. But, well, no one really knows for sure. I mean, it's the same thing with the Green River Killer. You never know how many he killed. I mean, you never really know for sure. In December of 1987, 6 months after I was born, Bundy was examined for 7 hours by Dorothy Otnow Lewis, a professor from New York University Medical Center. Lewis diagnosed Bundy as a manic depressive whose crimes usually occurred during his depressive episodes. Now, manic depressive to me is more like you just can't stop crying and every little thing hurts your feelings. Manic depressive to me doesn't go, fucking kill that bitch. Like, I don't know that that's...
Murder.
Yeah, murder. I'm so sad right now. I want to wipe my tears of blood. It just doesn't sound... Like I feel like manic. I mean, but then again, I'm not a psychologist, so who knows how manic really is with manic depression. To Lewis, Bundy described his childhood, especially his relationship with his maternal grandparents, Samuel and Eleanor Cowell. According to Bundy, so it's based off of how he would describe his relationship with them. Now, if you remember, if we go back, his relationship with them was not good. A realm of belief where people think that his grandfather actually molested his mom, and that's how Bundy was born, because they never really figured out who Bundy's real dad was. So it might be a case of where he's got like a daddy grandpa.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And he was raised for the longest time to believe that his mom was actually his sister and his grandparents were his parents in the first place. Like, he had like a weird little... And then the whole story of him finding his birth certificate and just... I mean, he wasn't right since. According to Bundy, grandfather Samuel Cowell was a deacon in his church. Along with the already established description of his grandfather as a tyrannical bully, Bundy described him as a bigot who hated blacks, Italians, Catholics, and Jews. He further stated, which I think is also odd, that the polar opposite of all those things that his grandfather hated was a middle-class white female. And yet, that became his target. Trying to figure him out is impossible, but I mean, that could be something. He further stated that his grandfather tortured animals, beating the family dog and swinging neighborhood cats by their tails. He also told Lewis how his grandfather kept a large collection of pornography in his greenhouse, where, according to relatives, Bundy and a cousin would sneak to look at it for hours. Now, I mean, I remember finding my grandfather's nudie mags. I never went to prison for murder.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. I've never murdered. I guess I should really really establish that as well.
Man.
You know what I mean? Kicking the dot. I mean, none of it sounds too crazy. And it's what's even weirder is that he's describing his grandfather's obsession with pornography and his grandfather's cruelties to animals. But the McDonald Triad states that most serial killers play a fire, wet the bed, are harmful to animals. And then, not just that, but most serial killers also end up having some sort of strange attachment to pornography. And Bundy later actually tries to claim that his addiction to pornography and pornography is like the true evil of the world. And I mean, I feel like pornography is probably more responsible for keeping kids from murdering.
I mean, that would make sense.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm saying you shouldn't hope to have what you see in the movies happen in real life, but at the same time, like, if you can get it out real quick, your aggression comes way down.
Yeah, I mean,
easily. Yeah. So family members express skepticism over Louise's Jack Worthington story of Bundy's parentage and noted that Samuel Cowell once flew into a violent rage when the subject of the boy's father came up. Bundy described his grandfather as a timid and obedient wife, or his grandmother, sorry, as a timid and obedient wife who was sporadically taken to hospitals to undergo shock treatment for depression. Such a crazy time. Toward the end of her life, Bundy said that she became agoraphobic. So I'm assuming that's, if I'm reading it correctly, agoraphobic is when you're afraid of germs. You stay in your house, everything's clean, you won't go out because you're afraid of the germs of the world. Louise Bundy's younger sister Julia recalled a disturbing incident with her young nephew. After lying down in the Cowell's home for a nap, Julia woke to find herself surrounded by knives from the Cowell kitchen, which we discussed on the very first episode when we were talking about young Bundy. So Ted was standing by the bed, smiling at her. Bundy also used stolen credit cards to purchase more than 30 pairs of socks while on the run in Florida. He was a self-described foot fetishist. So we go from obsession of knives when younger to being a foot fetishist, and I don't think that there's any throwing, and yet he never hurt anybody's feet. He never did anything weird to the feet. So I'm not sure why they felt the need to point out the fact that he had a thing for feet. In the Dobson interview before his execution, Bundy said that violent pornography played a major role in his sex crimes. According to Bundy, as a young boy, he found outside the home again and the local grocery store and a local drugstore the softcore pornography that people called softcore. And from time to time, we would come across pornographic books of harder nature, Bundy said. It happened in stages, gradually. My experience with pornography generally, but with pornography that deals on a violent level with sexuality, is once you become addicted to it. And I look at this as a kind of addiction like other kinds of addictions. I would keep looking for more potent, more explicit, more graphic kinds of material until you reach a point where the pornography only goes so far. You reach that jumping off point where you begin to wonder if maybe actually going and doing it would give that which is beyond just reading it or looking at it.
Give that extra thrill.
Right. That was like his jumping out of an airplane.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I get that. I'm not going to say that there isn't a progression there. But when I was a kid, we were joking about this the other day. I've got four little boys that we're raising. And so when we were kids, like, oh, dude, there's a Kmart bra ad on the table. You know what I mean? Or like as you, because we didn't have the internet when we were kids.
Yeah.
Like that's still, whether you believe it or not, you're listening to us on an internet format. But it's still a recent development. It's not something that we all had when we were kids. I'm 33 fucking years old. I sure as fuck didn't have the internet growing up. You know, like we had dial-up AOL, so you know what I'm talking about. Like there's no watching porn on the internet.
No, your parents would wake up in the middle of the night just hearing that.
Right, right. So, and plus, I don't know about you, but the way that our internet worked is that we didn't have internet unless we got like the free 500 hour discs in the mail,
okay,
so you can try it out. That's the only time we ever had internet. But yeah, there was a progression there. You start off with like your little bra ads, and then you see like a Victoria's Secret or Frederick's of Hollywood ad, and then eventually you find magazines, and the next thing you know you're trying to watch the Spice Channel all fucking digitized on TV, but you're like, oh, I think that was a nipple.
Showtime.
Yeah, and then you're staying up late and you're watching softcore and Cinemax. Yeah, fucking G-string divas. So, but there was definitely a escalation there, and it sounds like his escalation led him to be like, I need blood. So, in a letter written shortly before his escape from the Glenwood Springs jail, which, I don't know if you listened to any of the previous episodes that I've done, but this motherfucker escaped jail twice.
Yeah.
He escaped jail twice.
Yeah, I remember that.
Jumped out of a fucking window. Like, he paced back and forth in his tiny cell to get ready to do that jump. He's just insane. Anyway, before his escape from the Glenwood Springs jail, Bundy said, I have known people who radiate vulnerability. Their facial expressions say, I'm afraid of you. These people invite abuse by expecting to be hurt, Do they subtly encourage it? In a 1980 interview speaking of a serial killer's justification of his actions, Bundy said, "So what's one less? What's one less person on the face of the planet?" When Florida detectives asked Bundy to tell them where he had left Kimberly Leach's body for her family's solace, Bundy allegedly said, "But I'm the most cold-hearted son of a bitch you'll ever meet." Which, the irony of that statement, and then the people, the amount of people who were sitting outside when he was executed. Like, it was like Woodstock.
Yeah.
Like, that's fucking crazy.
They're selling homemade shirts and shit. And
right. Everything. Now, Bundy was a fucking monster. Okay? No ifs, ands, or buts about it. But the one thing that he did do, we're going to cover here, that it's, we're going to change, we're going to cover what he actually did to help. Yeah, I hate the word help. He made criminal profilers, and he made different police thought processes and actions start happening. One of the main things is having a central database for these murderers, because Bundy's murders stemmed from Washington to Oregon to Utah to Florida to Colorado. Like, he went literally across the U.S.
Yeah.
Just raping and pillaging, you know. And the reason it took so long to catch him is because all these states didn't have a centralized database to just go to, you know, whether it be even just like files sent over. I mean, they had something.
Yeah, like we were talking about, they didn't have the internet.
Yeah, and I mean, and yet I also think, though, that they didn't have any DNA tracking. Like, I, from all the research that I've done on other cases, the majority of what they were able to find from semen samples is figure out whether or not you're a non-secretor. All that means is whether or not they could tell your blood type from your semen. If your blood type, you know what I mean, if you're a non-secretor, your blood type doesn't pop up in your semen. And that's a low percentage of the population that's like that. So then you can go back and check your database that way.
Yeah.
But outside of that, they didn't have any, your DNA wasn't a thing, you know?
Yeah, they couldn't, I mean, I'm sure he had plenty of jobs going through each fucking city.
Right.
And they had no way to check his background at that point either. So even like the job sense of it, not even the police sense.
But right, know even knowing that he was a suspect. Yeah, even knowing he was just a suspect in a crime a while back, yeah, they wouldn't have even known that. That's a really good point. So they had nothing to go on. They had absolutely nothing to go on anywhere else. So anyway, so I found this really cool article called The Depths of Depravity. All right, so it says, Savvy Sociopath Changes Police Methods, which sounds really cool. So this one's actually done by Kevin Heldman. It's important for me to know who did it, who wrote it, because if I'm going to be using their shit, you're supposed to, you know, because not all research, I mean, there's so much goddamn Ted Bundy shit out there. I got a lot of my information from the Ted Bundy tapes. We talked about that awesome criminal profiler, Rachel. We've used a lot of materials from a lot of people, but this article in particular I thought was really cool, because he points out how his profile, how he was, and how he changed things. So there's going to be a lot of, again, repeat information in here, because you're going to get that, but it's just lay with me here. This is just kind of interesting shit. So Ted Bundy was a young Republican, law student, avid skier, crisis hotline volunteer, and the boy next door. I mean, this dude sounds like the American fucking dream, right? He sounds like that dude's going to go far. He should be right now owning a tech company somewhere in Silicon Valley. On top of that, the weirdest part to me, and I know everybody brings this up and everybody mentions it, is the fact that he was a suicide hotline counselor. Right. Like, that's fucking crazy to me. Anyway. The boy next door, right? But he was also a cannibal, a necrophiliac, charismatic, sociopath, and the man whose name came to define the term serial killer for the 20th century. Now, though there was at least 57 documented cases of serial killings in America since 1900, we're talking Gein, we're talking Richard Chase, Richard Ramirez. I mean, holy shit, the list goes on and on. Like, we spent all of our time, the Hillside Stranglers, like, we spent a lot of time in the 70s. And we're going to spend more time in the 70s, because next season, which is going to be starting in January, we're going to be covering cults, which is going to be a lot to do in the 70s. A lot in the, like, I'm romancing a lot in the fucking 70s. Jonestown, a lot in the 70s. Anyway, so he came to define the term serial killer. Now, Bundy changed the landscape. the man who admitted to killing at least 30 women between 1973 and 1978. Some experts believe he killed more than 100, which, you know, whatever, was a remarkable criminal in several ways. So we know this. Okay, he was a remarkable criminal. Now, in 1974, when we had our first Bundy crime that we knew of, the phenomenon wasn't just very well known. It just was not very well known. They weren't used to this shit, said Robert Keppel, a former homicide detective and author of The Riverman, okay, an account of his search for Washington's Green River Killer and his attempt to enlist Ted Bundy's assistance. Now, what makes him unique from a lot of others is the range and the span with which he committed his murders across state lines. Across the whole country. Bundy killed in as many as 10 states, more than any serial killer in American history. He killed in more states than I have fucking visited. University of Louisville criminology professor Ronald M. Holmes, who spent 2 years corresponding with Bundy as well as interviewing him in prison, said Bundy's propensity for travel corresponded with the advent of the nation's interstate system and the increased reliability of transportation, which is very interesting because they say that the reason there's so many serial killings happening in the 70s in California and LA at the time is because the amount of lead that was in the air from the fuel because of the interstates connecting so much. So I guess LA has always had a problem with smog and pollution and stuff, and they're saying that the amount of lead that was actually in the air, because lead actually like stimulates your aggression, they're saying that's what led to so many serial killings in the 70s. Like, isn't that just like that sounds far-fetched as fuck, but when you think about, I mean, now there's no longer lead-based paint, there's no longer da-da-da, but when we had lead-based paints in schools, there wasn't any fucking mass shootings in schools.
You know what I mean? Like, you don't let your kids eat lead-based paint, or they
might
have some learning problems.
You know? But then again, at the same time, I mean, you know, there was also asbestos that calmed them the fuck down. So, anyway. But yeah, so that's, they say that. So, Bundy, as well as interviewing in prison, interstate system, and the increased reliability of transportation. Prior to Bundy, most serial killers murdered in their own backyards. Gein. Even Jeffrey Dahmer kind of stayed in his own little spot. He actually buried the bodies in his house. We haven't done Dahmer yet. We're going to do Dahmer. Dahmer's a very interesting case. He's essentially somebody who was so ashamed of his own homosexuality that he murdered younger men and hid them under his floorboards in his house. He was a fucking freak, too. And I believe Dahmer was actually the one that dressed up like a clown a lot. There was always that serial killer clown.
That was Wayne Gacy, wasn't it?
No, oh, yeah, it was John Wayne Gacy. You're right. Oh, wow, look at you fucking coming out of nowhere. Look at you. Anyway, Bundy was the first to deviate significantly from that pattern, establishing the model for the modern-day multiple murderer, a new breed of killer. Bundy was a type of killer police hadn't encountered before. They weren't yet equipped to deal with him. His case had a great effect on the way law enforcement collects information about killers, Keppel said. There was no central repository of murder information anywhere in the United States at that time. Think about that. There was no central hub for any type of killings anywhere. And yet now, fucking someone stubs a toe, everybody on Facebook knows it.
Yeah.
Like, it's fucking crazy.
The information's so out there now.
Yeah, everything. And then, not just that, but, you know, with the advent of cell phones, they, anytime there's a silver alert or an amber alert, like, boom, everybody's phone goes off in the area.
Yeah.
Like, you know when a fucking dust storm is coming. It's crazy to think of a time where they didn't have that. Like, even, like, when they used to do, like, the radio, boo-doo, on the radio.
Yeah.
This is a check of the national security, whatever the fuck. For those of you who aren't in the U.S., an amber alert is when a child goes missing, and a silver alert is when an old person goes missing. And more often than not, the child abduction is typically one of the other parents, and the other parent called it in. And a silver alert is typically somebody who's, like, got Alzheimer's or somebody who's a little bit more senile, and they just venture off on their own, and their family can't find them.
Make their way to their car and...
Right.
Not seen for a while.
But they let everybody in the area know and give you the serial number, or not serial number, the...
License plate number
to know to look for them.
What type of car, yeah.
Right. And if it's an old person, they'll be driving on the wrong side of the freeway anyway. So although some experts disagree, Keppel said that Bundy's case was instrumental in the development of VICAP, Violent Criminal Apprehension Program, an FBI database designed to collect and link information on serial homicides. The FBI began using VICAP in 1985. So to really put that into perspective, they said, fuck this, we're done with that, 10 states, 40 women, like, we need to figure this the fuck out. And the FBI was like, we got this, VICAP. So he inadvertently implemented a better way to get everybody else caught. Bundy's geographical range left investigators with the laborious task of phoning individual police departments across the United States and combing through piles of desperate murder records. It was Bundy, by proxy, who taught the FBI the value of a central murder database. It took my partner and I a year and a half to collect information on over 90 murders in western states, said Keppel. If everybody cooperated in the VICAP program and submitted their crimes, it would have been a matter of fucking seconds. Now, the media's darling Bundy, with a hand from the media, changed the face of the serial killer as well. According to Holmes, who has profiled more than 375 murder and rape cases. I'm going to have to look this dude up. The public image of the serial killer before Bundy was the psychopathic, he's just psychotic, demented freak with gross physical impairments, like Frankenstein's fucking monster. But then Bundy comes along and says, hey, I'm just like the guy next door. I'm the stranger beside you. He said, referring to the title of crime writer Ann Rule's book about Bundy. Holmes said there were serial killers before Bundy who were just as charismatic, just as all-American, but they didn't get the media representation Bundy did. We serial killers are your sons, we are your husbands, we are everywhere. Bundy is quoted in Harold Schenker's book, The A to Z Encyclopedia of Serial Killers. A PhD in serial killing, Bundy called upon a potpourri, that was spelt wrong on here, potpourri of serial killer traits and a vast reserve of deviance. According to various accounts, he stored severed heads in his home and was a loner who was simultaneously engaged to women while he was killing. And he wasn't, they say he was a loner, I guess he kind of was, but he put up a really good front. I mean, he was like an undercover Republican sneaking into Democratic conventions. I mean, he was like the weirdest damn little right-wing spy. I mean, he did a lot. He had a lot of friends, and even in the Ted Bundy tapes, a lot of people spoke highly of him from when he was younger.
Yeah.
So I don't know about the whole loner thing, but I mean, at the same time, though, he never really felt like anybody was on his level either, so maybe self-proclaimed loner. He incinerated skulls in his fireplace. He vacuumed up the ashes. He redressed dead victims and their flesh. Lameness to lure victims and faked accents. We already covered all that. I don't know about the fake. I didn't hear about any of the faked accents part. Like, it's in the 1970s. It must have been so fucking racist for him to fake accents.
Yeah.
You know, he said, "Me, your friend of Bundy." Like, I can't imagine he was doing any justice. You know what I mean? Like, hey, get your ass over here. You know, just fucking top of the morning to you. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, most people don't know that about back then.
But he fucking, you know. Anyway, he kept one of his victims. It had to all be British accents, dude. I mean, if we're being honest, it was all British accents. That's like the,
because like,
we had the BBC
Southern accent.
Or a Southern accent. Yeah, I could see that too. He kept one of his victims in his possession for 9 days. He twice escaped from custody, was an experienced cat burglar, and insisted on strangling his victims while he looked directly into their fucking eyes. Bundy looked upon serial killing as a macabre mixture of sport, craft, and intellectual pursuit. A 1992 investigative report stated that Bundy went on dry runs, picking up a woman and releasing her unharmed to test his skills. Which, that's the little allowances. That's what that buildup is. In interviews, he compared killing to learning how to be a better repairman or cook. He told interviewers he had a PhD in serial killing. Killing only the best victims. Perhaps Bundy's most significant impact on the public consciousness was the breadth of his killing and the identities of his victims. Bundy didn't kill prostitutes or drug dealers, which, unfortunately, a lot of the times, in a lot of these cases, prostitutes are like the number one hit. They're like a quick fix. He killed pretty young college girls. His crimes caused outrage and led to nationwide media coverage. He was killing the best and most attractive of the youth, said Holmes. He was killing college girls that were the future of America. They were very valuable victims. Now, my question is, did his killing continue because of the coverage. Like, he enjoyed being on TV. When they were talking about the whole Young Republicans thing and he was actually doing interviews and shit like that, like, he enjoyed that limelight.
Yeah.
Like, and now you've got people doing mass shootings. Like, we just had one in Arizona a couple months ago, dude. We had that kid that went to Westgate and was on Snapchat. Right. And he shot maybe three people, didn't kill anybody, and then his gun jammed.
Yeah.
But it's strange to me that, because I don't know how many of these mass shootings you followed, but you had the one kid that went in and shot the Baptist church about 4 years ago, 3 years ago, I want to say. I wish I remembered his name, but fuck him. And he didn't even so much as have a social media account. And he killed like 8 or 9 people. But then you have the other kid who flat out said he's doing it because no girl wants to sleep with him. Like, he's like, my dick's dry, so now it's going to be wet with your blood. And went, yeah, did you not see that?
No.
Yeah, Westgate in Phoenix. He went out to Westgate, and he was on Snapchat. And he was a good-looking young kid. He wasn't like an ugly chud or anything either. His hair was nice. He's all primped and proper and shit. You know, it looked like he was driving a nice car. And got out with his AR-15 and just started fucking trying to shoot one. He's trying to shoot an AR-15 with one hand while filming.
Yeah.
So he wasn't doing very well anyway. But it was all through Snapchats, dude. Via Snapchat, and said flat out, it's because no chick will give him the time of day. He's fucking, hey, gonna remember me now? Like, yeah. Yeah, and then his fucking gun jammed, and he got taken down. But that's just over the course of the last couple of years. That's a presidential term, dude, 4 years.
Yeah.
And you go from, like, no social media presence at all, socially awkward, fucking no one even knows about this kid, and he just loses his mind after going on, like, fucking 4chan and seeing some racist bullshit that he falls in line with and follows all these gay conspiracy. And also, if you're into this fucking QAnon bullshit, we already discussed QAnon, I already talked about it in another episode, and QAnon is just getting fucking crazier and crazier and crazier with their Wayfair fucking whatever the fuck. And then recently I read a conspiracy theory based around this corona, the COVID. I know I've been trying not to talk about fucking COVID-19 this episode, but I read a conspiracy theory that's actually being passed around through the super right-wing conservative Christian movement, and they're actually saying that the COVID-19 vaccine could be the mark of the beast and bring about the final days and the rapture. I read that 4 fucking days ago. That is a true article that is, like, it's not even Westboro Baptist Church shit. This is just, like, right-wing fucking Christian, like, traditionalists, the kind that won't let their kids get blood transfusions when they're sick, like the really, really hardcore, strict Christians. They're saying that it's the mark of the beast and that Christ will rise, the rapture will happen, and that we have to go through the 7 years of fucking war on hell and earth. That is the most recent conspiracy theory I've looked up.
They're fucking, that is ridiculous.
Like, that would be such a fun fucking podcast episode to cover. I'm serious. Like, so me and LaVon have actually been discussing the idea. I know, I'm getting off topic. But me and LaVon, when I did the crossover episode with Rap Sheets, you go back, listen to that one. It was a fun episode. We're talking about Jam Master Jay and his murders that got caught. So it wasn't just like, yo, MTV Raps. We actually covered a cold case. But anyway, me and LaVon have been discussing for years about doing a conspiracy theory podcast. Now, LaVon, I don't know if you could tell, but based off the name LaVon, he's a little darker than me, right? So, and I'm Chris, so I'm a little, I'm a very, 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 very pale man, and LaVon is my photo negative, right? We've been best friends for years. But me and LaVon have always joked about doing a conspiracy podcast where it's like how black people view conspiracy theories and how white people view conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
Right? So I can only imagine it'd be me like, dude, did you see this shit? And he'd be like, nah, man, that sound like some fake shit. You believe that shit? That sound like some fake shit. And I'd be like, no, listen to me. There's lizard demons in the center of the earth, and they feed on our fear. And he'd be like,
white people always believe that kind of shit.
Yeah, and then he'd be like, nah, man, you want to talk real conspiracy theory? How come they got grape-flavored menthol cigarettes? You know what I mean? Like, I could just see him fucking change that shit around. I'd be sitting there going like, you know, they're fucking the central baking. And LaVon be like, nah, bro. I think that Trader Joe's parking lot is smaller on purpose to make him look more busy. Which, that's a Kyle Kinane joke. I'm not going to keep, that's not me, but fucking, like, I'm just saying, like, he'd be really rational.
Yeah.
And then I'd be the fucking like, nah, man, aliens. So,
lizard people. Fucking, the devil.
This is why the earth is flat. Galileo. So, anywho. So we're getting back on topic here. Ted Bundy. So all the shit that he did, including serving as his own defense attorney. Bundy dragged out his execution for almost 11 years with all of his addendums. They're not addendums. I always forget this fucking word. Not addendum. When you challenge the courts. You challenge the courts. I always forget that fucking word. It starts with an A.
Appeal?
Appeal. Yes, thank you. Man, again, out of nowhere. Yeah, yeah. With all his appeals. Bundy even managed to somehow have a daughter while incarcerated. Right, his best friend, you got to go back and watch the Ted Bundy tapes, because they talk about it in the very last episode, but he was like, there's pictures of him with his family, like, in his cell, trying to be like a normal dad, like, what the fuck, dude? Like, the amount of arrogance from that sociopath was insane. He's still like, I can still have a fucking family, watch me raise her, you know?
Pretty much.
So, yeah, so snippets of his televised trial in Miami came into people's homes on the news each night. So he was in their face. Not only was he in their face, but he was acting like he was smarter than everybody else in the room on camera in your home. And by the time he was executed in 1989 at the age of 42, Bundy was so widely despised that according to Schechter's book, people gathered outside the prison where he was to be electrocuted to toast his death. And with champagne across the state of Washington, Keppel said taverns in every city put a billboard celebrating his impending execution. There were signs that said, drink to Bundy. And other people had that, like, fry Bundy fry. And you saw all the other things. I even posted the pictures on the Facebook for the thing. But that essentially is, he helped create, whether they want to give him credit or not, he was responsible for actually creating VICAP. And with Keppel, there's actually a book that Keppel wrote, which is actually all based around him interviewing Bundy and picking his brain, and Bundy actually helping him with certain aspects of profiling and catching the Green River Killer.
Yeah.
Like, that's Hannibal Lecter type shit. Right? You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Right? That's like a very attractive Hannibal Lecter being like, hello, Clarice. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Did you bring me the dirty panties to sniff? You know what I mean?
Panties.
Yeah, like he did all kinds of crazy shit, and he literally changed the game. And unfortunately, as I've always heard people say, there is no progress without sacrifice. And it sucks that all those young women were the sacrifice, but now you can't pull that shit. There's no serial killers anymore.
There's no way they can get away with it.
But now there's mass shootings. And is that... I guess this will be for another episode to actually really get into. Maybe do like a I don't want to say best of episode. That's terrible. But like a montage episode. There you go. Because I almost said greatest hits. That's terrible too. Montage episode of mass shootings. Because there's so little profile behind these guys. It's like I've tried to do episodes based on mass shootings and tried to do research on them.
Yeah.
And like Ted Bundy... books upon books. You know what I mean? Fucking Ed Gein. Books upon books. Information upon information. You find articles and snippets of mass shootings, and then they're gone. And then it's like...
Because it happens so often. It's a new type of serial
killer. Yeah, yeah. It gets glossed over so much. It's like, where'd it happen? Like, you didn't even know about the one that happened in Arizona.
Yeah.
Like, and that was just a couple fucking months ago. Like, that's insane, right? And then we had the... I mean, the other recent one to talk about is the one... There was one that happened in El Paso. You remember that one at the Walmart?
Yeah.
That one was a big fucking deal.
I heard about that
one. And then there was one that happened in Denton, Ohio. That was a big one.
So, I might have heard about that.
That was last year sometime. Okay. There, I mean, there's literally too many to count. I'm trying to remember, I think it was also Texas, that a mass shooter went into a church and an ex, Texas Marshall was one of the flock of that church. And he had actually been training people in there to shoot. So the guy came in with a shotgun, shot down two people, and by the time he was getting ready to shoot down his third, that marshal, ex-marshal, stood up, turned around, right between the fucking eyes. Had his gun in church. Stood up, boom, dropped him.
Yeah.
Like, that could have been way fucking worse if he didn't have that gun. So, just food for thought. Once again, we are not sponsored by Abide Armory, but if you do need to find any self... defense weapons with all this other craziness going on in the world, check out abidearmory.com. That's my brother-in-law Ben's business. He's got a lot of the hard to find shit right now because he's got a really good deal going with the company Davidson's Distribution. So maybe you guys could hit him up, get you guys some ammo, get some guns, whatever it is you need while we still have them. And then for foreign countries, I can't help you. Sorry. But what you can do, if you can't buy a gun, is you can go to ageofradio.org and you can check out all the other podcasts on there. It's not just my podcast. It's not just Rap Sheets with LaVon and Jet. It's a great podcast on there. You got Breakdown from the Couch. You've got Under the Midnight Sun. There's everything from cryptozoology to fucking ghost hunting to business advice, self-help, even UFC podcasts. Now they've gotten really big into promoting a lot of the UFC podcasts. Sports podcast. So ageofradio.org, you'll find anything that tickles your fancy. And then if you are a sponsor and you're listening to podcasts, Age of Radio is always looking for more sponsors. So go check them out. Make sure to like and subscribe. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. I feel like I'm finally fucking done with Ted Bundy. I'm not doing any more shit on Ted Bundy, but he'll probably be a frame of reference and all my other shit going forward anyway. The next case I'm going to do is going to be Richard Ramirez. I promised a buddy, and it's also in the same timeline. And it's going to tie into another story that we did. I believe it was not Richard Chase, but the Hillside Stranglers. One of the detectives that helped catch the Hillside Stranglers also helped catch Richard Ramirez and was a key player in Richard Ramirez's case. And we've been able to tie all our little stories into each other, except for Ted Bundy. Ted Bundy's been the outlier. The next side profile is going to be a long episode on Led Zeppelin. Excuse me. I'm going to cover their career because we've done a couple music things and we haven't really talked about their musical career. And I feel like that's kind of leaving some of the shit out. That's why we're covering them. So we're going to talk about their musical career, their retirement. And we're also going to talk about essentially pedophilia, drug use, money laundering. You fucking name it. Led Zeppelin are legends in their own right musically, and they are fucking monsters personally. And we'll cover that on the next side profile. And that's it. And then I think Richard Ramirez will take us into the new year, and then we start on our cult edition. If you guys have any suggestions for which cult you'd like me to do first, centartainment@gmail.com. The links are always in the show description. Profiling Pain Podcast on Instagram and Facebook. I need to get a Twitter. I just kind of keep refusing to do so. And then merchandise. I swear to God, before the end of the year, I have the fucking link. I have everything I need to do it. I just haven't posted it yet. Honestly, with everybody being at home and not able to spend a lot of money frivolously, I don't want to be like, hey guys, help out the show, go buy a shirt, because I feel like that's a dick move. But maybe you guys got someone in the house that really likes this podcast, and so I should do that so you can get them a shirt for Christmas, right? Fucking right.
There you go.
So, anyway. It's almost Christmas time. It's almost Christmas time, that's right. So, that's going to be on Teespring and possibly Redbubble, so I'll give you the link to that on the Led Zeppelin episode, because that will be the next one that's going to drop. That's essentially it. Anthony, do you have anything to add?
Fucking, let's go Colts.
Let's go Colts. That's right. He didn't say let's go Colts. He's not an Indianapolis fan. He said let's go Colts. He says I want some brainwashed motherfuckers doing dirty deeds right now.
I want
to
get into that shit.
So, but anyway, that was the episode. Anthony, thank you very much for sitting with me and listening to me ramble on.
Okay, thanks.
And then to all you guys, stay happy, stay healthy. Pimping ain't easy, and stay metal, mofos. Have a good one. Right.